from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty. Today, why road repairs have taken a back seat in Lansing.
In the 1950s and 60s and 70s in this state, there were certain things that were just a matter of the public interest, but we seem to have lost that.
Then, can teachers alone really make up for failing schools?
Despite these systemic inequities, despite sort of this history and these seemingly intractable problems, you have to believe that the things that you do in the classroom do matter.
Then, could Michigan soon join some 20 other states calling for a federal balanced budget amendment? Sounds good, right?
No, this is not a responsible way to do it.
And it's official. Youper makes its way into the Merriam-Webster Dictionary.
And I would say that if we're all using a word and we know what it means, it's an actual word.
Those stories and more. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty. For years, there's been talk that Michigan needs to put more money into its roads. Governor Snyder has said he wants at least $1.2 billion annually for road maintenance and repair. And a new report says the state needs closer to $2 billion a year. But negotiations at the state capitol have stalled. That is until the last few weeks. Earlier this month, some $200 million was okayed in a supplemental budget. It looks like another deal could be in the works. Now, word on the street is that this is not some grand bargain deal. Instead, there are reports that the amount would be closer to $300, $400 million. But it's a start. The question, why now? Jack Lessenberry is Michigan Radio's political analyst. Hi, Jack.
Hi there.
So it seems to me there are two things behind this push. First, the fact that drivers are experiencing firsthand just how bad the roads have gotten after this year's crazy winter. And second, the fact that the year ends in an even number, i.e. that it's an election year. What else is going on here?
Well, the way I learned to understand politicians was in seventh grade science class when we had an experiment where we had a flatworm in a petri dish. If you put food particles in there, it moved toward it. And if you put a hot wire in there, it moved away from it. Politicians believe in the pleasure-pain principle. Obviously, anyone who really has to ask why people are suddenly talking about fixing the roads hasn't been outside. I've never seen potholes this bad. Nobody has. At first, actually, the Republicans in the state Senate started talking about a tax cut. And when that was explained, people got how ridiculous that was, especially when they saw the average taxpayer would get $88 a year back, which is less than one-third the amount to fix the average tire destroyed by a pothole.
Right.
So they sort of retrenched on that. But in a way, I almost wonder if this $200 million or $215 million, whatever it is, to repair the roads is a bad thing.
Explain why.
Because it lulls people into thinking they're actually doing something about it. As you said, the governor a couple of years ago said, we've got to spend $1.2 billion a year for the next 10 years if we're even to stay even with the roads, to restore the roads we have now to drivability and prevent them all from falling in the potholes and gravel. The legislature refused to do anything about it. This $200 million will fill in some potholes, but it won't address the basic problem, which, as you say, they're now saying the price tag has gone to $2 billion from $1.2 billion for the same reason that if you don't go to the dentist, you're eventually going to pay a lot more and have a lot more pain fixing your teeth. The roads get worse and worse, and it costs more and more to restore them.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Governor Snyder. He has really, since he took office, been pushing, as we mentioned, for more money, sort of fallen on deaf ears. Now there's a push for it. Does this sort of go back to this idea, as we were talking about, that all politics is personal, is local, that it takes a voter actually experiencing some sort of trouble, like a pothole, to actually get them to call their lawmaker and ask for help?
Well, that's true to some extent, which is why you're seeing this $215 million. But the real problem is that's not as effective as it used to be because of gerrymandering and the ideological nature of the parties. Most of the folks in the legislature, particularly Republicans, don't have to worry about the general election. They only have to worry about a primary election, and they're worried they're going to be challenged by a Tea Party person. There's one state senator, Patrick Colbeck from Wayne County, who doesn't believe we should spend any money on the roads, as far as I can tell. He thinks you just need to improve the economy, basically a free market economy, and eventually so much money will pour in that the roads will be fixed. Well, you know, that is sort of a very much a minority opinion, but there are people who think like that, and politicians, again, are concerned about their own personal survival. There are Democratic districts in the state where Abraham Lincoln couldn't win running as a Republican. Hmm. There's others where God couldn't win running as a Democrat. In fact, most of the districts in the legislature today are like that. And that has been, that coupled with term limits.
Right.
Term limits has been, I think, the worst thing ever to happen to man since the seven plagues, because what it means is that if a lawmaker who can only stay there 8 years can push a problem down the road 10 years, she or he will do that. And we're now seeing the fruits of that.
Yeah. Meanwhile, let's talk about Democrats who are trying to use this for political advantage. They've started this website, Snyderholes.com, trying to blame Governor Snyder for the state of the roads, asking people to upload photos of the largest potholes. Is this smart politics by the D's?
Well, it's cute, and I don't know how effective it's going to be. Democrats are certainly not innocent here either. In fact, there's some indication they're dragging their feet on another needed reform, education, because they'd rather make the governor look bad than do the right thing. But it's all very cute, and it's all very political, and what we need is adults. We need adults to say we need to put partisan politics on hold here and fix the roads and have a grand bargain where everybody agrees on some formula to fix the roads. The governor actually had one tied largely to the gas tax, which I still happen to think would be less painful because the price of gas fluctuates so much that people would have a hard time noticing. But however we do it, we need to, it should be a bipartisan thing. We need to fix the roads. And this used to be how people thought in the 1950s and 60s and 70s in this state, that there were certain things that were just a matter of the public interest. But we seem to have lost that.
So that's what you're hoping, you're pushing for to happen, will it? We've got lawmakers getting ready for their spring break. They're going to come back. They're going to be dealing with the next fiscal year's budget, issues about Detroit. Will road funding, will some kind of bargain happen in the next couple months, particularly, I should say, before the election?
I think if people scream enough, maybe. It's highly unlikely, but people have to. The trouble is the public is, in a large sense, like a six-week-old puppy. They're easily distracted by shiny objects and loud noises and food and baseball games. But I think the potholes are so bad now, and as the thaw happens, if we ever do get spring in this state, even more of them. And I'm hoping that some, you know, wisdom prevails. Of course, in journalism, you know, we're supposed to declare if we have a conflict of interest or any skin in the game, and I certainly do because I drive a lot. I've lost one brand new tire this year so far. My car is in the shop today getting an alignment, and like everybody else in the state, I want the potholes fixed. I want to have passable roads, and the insanity of this is that, which the governor understands and his fellow Republicans apparently don't, is that we need to attract new business to the state. But I don't know how you attract new business to the state when your main highways look like the back roads in Guatemala.
Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Radio's political analyst. As always, thanks so much, Jack.
Next time I'll tell you what I really think.
Welcome, dear Youper. No, I'm not talking to you specifically who lives above the bridge in the Upper Peninsula. I'm talking about the actual word, Youper. You are official. That's according to the 2014 edition of Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary. Ann Curzan is an English professor at the University of Michigan, and she joins us every Sunday on Michigan Radio for That's What They Say. Hey, Ann.
Hello.
So, Ann, we've all been using Youper for years and years, right? How did it take this long for it to become an actual word?
I think we should start with when a word becomes an actual word.
Love it.
The word Youper is actually already in the American Heritage Dictionary. So it has gotten recognition in a standard dictionary already. And I would say that if we're all using a word and we know what it means, it's an actual word. It's then a question of when dictionary editors decide to include it in their dictionaries.
Fair enough. So why now? Why Merriam-Webster saying, okay, we're ready for you, Youper?
Well, there's been a campaign by a Upper Peninsula resident to get the word Youper into the Merriam-Webster dictionary, which has now been successful. And the key was to convince the dictionary editors that it wasn't just a regionalism. It wasn't a word that was just restricted to, for example, people in the UP or people in Michigan, but this was a term that speakers and writers of English might encounter outside of the region.
Okay. And what about the history of the word Youper? How did it come to be?
Well, our first citations of the word come in the late 1970s. The word Youper shows up in the Dictionary of American Regional English, which is a wonderful dictionary that is designed to capture the regional terms as opposed to the standard terms that everyone may know. And their first citation is 1977 in the Escanaba Daily Press. I've also seen some people date it to 1979, but DARE has it in 1977 in a name contest. And people were suggesting different names for folks who live in the Upper Peninsula. And Uper, along with UPite and some other possibilities, were suggested. And then we have citations from the late 70s on of people picking up the term Uper and using it.
Okay, so Uper, obviously going to be a noun. And what will the definition be? Just something along the lines of, you know, nickname for a resident of Michigan's Upper Peninsula or something like that?
The definition in the Dictionary of American Regional English is a person who lives in or is from Michigan's Upper Peninsula. And they also have that it is the dialect of a person who is from the UP. So people will sometimes talk about talking Uper. And then what I love is that the Dictionary of American Regional English also says sea troll, which if you are from Michigan or live in Michigan, you may know as a term for those of us who live in the lower peninsula. Underneath the bridge.
That is so great. Anne Curzan, English professor at University of Michigan, and also joins Michigan Radio's Rena Miller every Sunday for That's What They Say. Anne, thanks so much.
Thanks, Zoe.
And we should note, as Anne said, that Uper is now in the Merriam-Webster Dictionary because of Gladstone resident Steve Parks pushing Merriam-Webster since 2002. It actually started because Parks was playing Scrabble with a friend. The friend challenged his use of the word in the game Scrabble. We have done some math. We have figured it out. Now that Uper is officially allowed when you play it in Scrabble, that is worth 11 points. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. You don't have to go very far to find critics of Michigan schools, of the way children are learning, of what they're learning. There are countless statistics that try to measure the problems. For example, when it comes to education in the U.S., students are lagging behind their peers in other countries. When you look at standardized tests, American students rank 17th in reading, 23rd in science, 31st in math. That puts American students behind those in Poland and Slovenia. But what we want to explore here for the next few minutes is just how much pressure we should put on individual teachers to fix these problems. Cynthia recently spoke with three teachers who are all earning their PhDs in education at the University of Michigan: Natalie Davis, Alistair Bomfrey, and Martha Curran Price.
First, we welcome Natalie Davis. So tell us a little about yourself, Natalie. Where'd you go to school?
Well, I grew up in Detroit, so I attended public school in Detroit. After that, I moved on to New York, and so I did my undergrad at Columbia University. And I was trained to be a teacher there as well.
And what teaching have you done and where?
So I was trained to be a teacher in New York. So I did teaching in like non-traditional contexts. So I did some adult education things and some mentoring, tutoring things sort of outside of the formal classroom context. And then I did my student teaching in secondary chemistry at a school in the Bronx. And I also did some practicum work at a middle school also in the Bronx in New York. Then I moved from there to Chicago, and I was a third grade teacher on the south side of Chicago.
And here you are getting your doctorate now in education
yes,
at U of
ma'am.
M. And next, we welcome Alistair Bomfrey. Same questions for you. Where are you from? And tell us about the teaching you've done, Alistair.
Okay. So I grew up in Bay City, Michigan, and went to public school up there. And around 2000, I did the New York City Teaching Fellows, which is a kind of Teach for America-like mm-hmm. program. It's an alternative pathway.
Mm-hmm.
I was teaching up in Washington Heights in Manhattan and at the same time getting my master's and going through a teacher preparation program at City College of New York.
What level did you teach?
I taught high school.
You were
high school English.
Okay.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And we have Martha Curran Price, and we get to ask you the same questions. Tell us where you're from and the teaching that you've done.
Well, I grew up in Philadelphia also. A product of the public school system, and went into teaching a little bit late in my mid-20s. I went through a traditional master's program, and mm-hmm. after that I taught in a Philadelphia charter school, which is publicly funded but not your traditional neighborhood public school. Mm-hmm. And I was a 5th, 6th, and 7th grade language arts teacher.
Okay, so we have a broad array of experiences mm-hmm. here. And we brought the three of you together knowing you're clearly committed to teaching and to education, or you would not be going after these PhDs in education, and knowing that you have stood in front of classrooms around the country. And so we're looking for your thoughts on a central question, and that is this: can individual teachers truly make up for failings in our education system? And Natalie, I know you were a student in Detroit Public Schools. You taught in Chicago. So let me have you answer that question first.
Well, I think that to a certain extent we have to believe that. I think that that's true in any profession, that individuals definitely have an immense amount of potential to be able to really make strides in within their own domain. I teach a course for pre-service teachers now, and essentially, like, that's the ongoing thread, like, within the course, is that despite sort of these systemic inequities, despite sort of this history and these seemingly intractable problems within education, that you have to believe that the things that you do in the classroom do matter. Mm. And they do matter for those students. They'll matter for their lives, their own educational trajectories. They'll matter for their communities. And so that's not something to take lightly, I don't think.
That's a good point. What about you, Alistair? What do you think?
I think similar to Natalie, I think, yeah. I mean, it's individual teachers who are, you know, on the ground in American classrooms working with kids. And so, yeah, we have to think that they can make a huge difference. But I think another question is put in a systemic support system to help those teachers do a really good job, and especially to help them when they're new. When they're really new to this hard work.
Mm-hmm. Hard work. And when we see the dropout rate in the first few years, and you look at that, Martha Curran Price, does that make you worried about the long haul for you, or are you just fired up and ready to go out and do it?
I think that's part of it. I think, though, that something important to remember is that teaching is really hard work the same way every profession mm-hmm. requires really hard work. So the same way that doctors in medical school need to learn a set of skills and practices and do those things well, so do teachers. And so the burden should be, of course, on teachers to learn those things, but it should also be on us institutionally to really define those things for teachers that they need to be able to do in classrooms, and then to do a great job teaching them how to do it.
When you see this research that finds, I saw the one statistic that nearly 50% of new teachers leave within 5 years. So mm-hmm. how do you think that we can create a sustainable model where teachers stay teaching and they don't throw in the towel? And I know, Alistair, you kind of touched on that about the kind of systemic changes. What do you think needs to change?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I just to touch mm-hmm. on the save the world mentality.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of alternative programs are capitalizing on the fact that a lot of young people want to come out of college and do just that, whether it's, you know, do AmeriCorps or Peace Corps mm-hmm. or something like Teach for America. I think that's part of Teach for America's recruiting strategy.
Yeah.
But I don't think that mentality is going to be enough to get somebody through those first difficult years. Mm-hmm. And I even have questions about, you know, like, what is the source of that I want to save the world kind mm-hmm. of mentality. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I think that new teachers, when they're there in the classroom, they need a support system, whether that's in the form of some curriculum guides or a mentor who's there on the ground in the classroom there to help the new teacher. I think that there needs to be support structures in place at the school. Mm-hmm. And I think oftentimes those structures are not there, especially in the schools that most need them.
Mm-hmm. What kind of structures should be there? Let's say if you could yeah. wave a wand, Natalie, and it's there, mm-hmm. the support structures are there, the system works to help teachers. What would that look like?
We do a really poor job of having those social networks, like within schools, having strong relationships between the school, the teacher, and the community, and drawing from resources within communities. I think that we have too many kids in classrooms, mm-hmm. and it becomes an almost impossible task to think that you can attend to all of their needs within sort of that given time period. I know that when I worked as a teacher in Chicago, for at least part of the time, I would have a teaching assistant. And it wasn't necessarily a consistent thing, but it made a huge difference at times, just for things like I have to go to the restroom, mm-hmm. or I have a concern that I need to deal with a kid or with their parent or with the administration, and just to know that I had someone who knew what we were doing in our classroom and knew that, okay, it's not, I can actually have my kids working on something productive if I'm distracted, because that's just what happens when you have 38-year-olds in a classroom. There's always something that could be a distraction. So I think that having smaller class sizes, for sure, having mentor teachers and people who actually come in your classroom and can give you constructive feedback and give you resources
based on years in the trenches.
I don't know if I'll call it the trenches, but definitely challenging work.
Yes.
And having someone else, a parent, a teaching assistant, someone who can really help, a co-teacher, someone who can help you manage the fact that you have 30 plus young people who all have different learning needs.
I'm speaking with Natalie Davis, Alistair Bomfrey, and Martha Curran Price. All have taught in classrooms around the country, and all are now earning their PhDs in education at the University of Michigan. Martha, in your classroom experience, did you see where teachers would go above and beyond buying supplies out of their own pockets or buying necessities for the poorest students?
Well, yes. I'd say yes, I do see that. Mm-hmm. The school that I worked at, though, got better funding because it was a public charter school.
Okay.
Than my counterparts, for instance, who worked in district schools, which
yes.
in Philadelphia, which tended to have less funding. At the same time, there are things that are supplied by the school. Sometimes you have curriculum materials, you have paper, sometimes you don't. The issue is more that thinking about ways to support teachers needs to be done not on a district-by-district or a school-by-school basis, but on a broader basis. Do all of the schools have what they need to support kids and teachers? And whether or not then, the degree, the grain size that you're looking at, what that actually mm-hmm. means, might vary. But are we being consistent in terms of providing supports to students and to teachers statewide, nationally?
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't just have to do with the kinds of supplies that teachers are having available in their classroom. Are we supporting teachers across states on a national level with the same specific knowledge base that they need mm-hmm. to teach?
And the answer to that right now would be
no.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I would just add that I think a lot of times the conversation becomes, how can we make sure that every school has the same resources, whether mm-hmm. that resource is, what are those called,
smart boards,
a smart board, a digital projector, whether it's technology, computers. I think that becomes the question. Does every school have the same – are they equal in terms of how much technology they have? But I think the conversation should be, are teachers being trained how to use that technology in a way that's mm-hmm. going to be useful for their students?
Well, that gets back to this achievement gap that the country spends a lot of time talking about, and knowing that – it is clear, just look in the state of Michigan and the variances between districts with what kind of resources are available. Mm-hmm. So is it naive, is it disingenuous to expect amazing, energetic teachers to, let's say, save inner city classrooms and close that achievement gap?
Yeah, so I think, the first thing is this, the achievement gap, mm-hmm. that terminology is troublesome to me. Mm-hmm. And it's used very widely, so it's very common. But there's been a lot of new research, literature, scholars have been trying to shift the focus and reframe the issue by talking about education debts, by talking about opportunity gaps. And so when you think about an achievement gap, that's looking more at what it is that students' capacity to be able to accomplish some type of academic task, to perform well on a standardized test. But when you look at the opportunity gap, now it's not so much about that outcome, but it's about whether or not students have had an equitable access to opportunities that would even allow them to be able to perform well on tests. And so that's really where the gap is that if you look in the difference between a classroom where students are high performing and the and you look at a classroom where students are perhaps not performing up to the standard or not performing as high, that you see a huge disconnect between the types of opportunities that they get in the classroom, mm-hmm. their access to curriculum, the experience level of their teachers, so that they're not even having opportunities to learn this content that would allow them to perform. And so that's the first piece.
How do we best hold our teachers accountable? What do you think, Alistair?
Right. As a teacher, I want to know my students' test scores. Mm-hmm. I think that's really helpful for me, especially if those test scores don't line up with my own feeling of how the year went. Maybe I think the year went great, and then I get these test scores back, and I find out that, maybe kids didn't learn quite as much as I thought they were learning. That's important. However, I do think that there's just, in terms of these numbers, this data, mm-hmm. there's so much noise there. It's really hard to determine the correlation between the teaching and that mm-hmm. student's scores. It's really hard to make that direct correlation there. So to the point where I don't think it's really fair to make hiring decisions based on those
or
kinds
salary
of,
decisions
or salary decisions based on those kinds of scores. Yeah.
What do you think, Natalie?
I think I agree. I think that it's really very problematic when I think about this whole idea of these hero teachers or these really extraordinary teachers, and most certainly they do exist, and mm-hmm. there are even more committed teachers who are committed to trying to improve and work really hard. But to use the exceptions as evidence that all teachers have that capacity to be able to step into their classroom and then all of a sudden, they make miracles happen, that's a little bit unfair. And I think that it shifts the attention away from those support networks, from administration, from districts, from teacher preparation programs to be able to help teachers build that capacity and help them to continually improve. So I do think as a teacher in your classroom, you have an immense amount of responsibility and you do some things very well. And we all make mistakes as teachers. But at the same time, I think that in the absence of having support systems within schools, having continual teacher professional development mm-hmm. that's actually impactful and not
useful.
Seen mm-hmm. as a waste, a waste of time or just something to fill space, then I think that it's not fair to have it be such a punitive system where teachers are being punished and they're the only ones that are sort of the martyrs and thrown out of the classroom when there were no supports in place for them to even improve.
So let me just throw this kind of final question out to have you get your thoughts. Do we, and I'll say we meaning society, should we be, I guess for lack of a better way of putting it, lower expectations of teachers and place expectations and pressure on other parties as well? Would it be school district administrators? Would it be state legislators who control the purse strings?
Teacher preparation programs. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Go ahead. Where does the pressure need to be extended to?
Look, I do think we need to put a lot of pressure on teachers mm-hmm, because this definitely. Is a high-risk profession, mm-hmm. much like a lot of other professions. I'd say, though, that we need to be really thinking about how we're letting people enter into the profession. So my recommendation mm-hmm. would be a huge thing that we need to shift is our thinking about our licensure system. Right now, teachers can become teachers by taking pen and paper tests without ever actually being assessed on their capacity to teach. Mm-hmm. And if we create a much stricter entry, I'm not talking about entry into teacher preparation programs. We know very little about what qualities or dispositions make for a good mm-hmm. teacher. I'm talking about teachers who have learned to teach and are then being assessed on their ability to enter classrooms. That's one thing that I think really needs to shift. Once we've let teachers into the classrooms, that's not the teacher's fault that they were allowed to teach. That's mm-hmm. our licensure system. Those are the teacher preparation programs that need to shift.
What do you think, Alistair?
I would say, improving the instructional capacity within schools. And so that means having people in schools who can help teachers be better teachers. Mm-hmm. And maybe that means having a principal who is prepared to be an instructional leader and not to just do the administrative side, which is also really important, but also is prepared to go into classrooms and help teachers become better teachers.
Like be a good coach.
Be a good coach, yep. And mm-hmm. and also have – and maybe have the veteran teachers in the building take on that kind of leadership as well. And also, having – I think it is important to have some sort of common guide, curriculum guide. I'm not saying necessarily like a strict curriculum mm-hmm. to talk about, to work around, but I think having something in common to – some standards. Having some common language helps people collaborate and talk about this thing that we're doing together.
So everybody's singing off the same page in the hymnal.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so
which I think is
look who gets the
helpful.
Final word. We started with Natalie, and Natalie gets the last
word.
No.
I think everyone should feel pressure. I think teachers in classrooms, you should feel that sense of urgency. I think administrators should feel a sense of urgency. I think parents and families and community members, this is the future. And I think that we take it too lightly sometimes. You think about kindergarten classrooms and it's like, oh, they're just, they're working on their letters, or in high school, or, oh, they're just learning how to write a 5-paragraph essay. But no, like we are determining and through classrooms, through raising children, like what our world will look like. And I just think that everyone should be fearful and everyone should feel a sense of urgency around that.
Natalie Davis, Alistair Bumphrey, and Martha Curran Price all have taught in classrooms around the country, and they're all earning their PhDs in education at the University of Michigan. It really was a pleasure to talk with all of you. Thank you so very much.
Glad to do it.
This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in for Cynthia Canty. Michigan could soon join about 20 other states that are formally calling for a national convention to draft a balanced budget amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Now, Michigan itself has a balanced budget requirement, but not so for the federal government. This idea of a balanced budget amendment has really taken off in the past few years as the nation's debt has increased. Let's turn to Charles Ballard, economist with Michigan State University, to kind of figure all of this out. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Zoe. How are you?
Good, thank you. So it sounds good, right? The country, we're in $17 trillion of debt. But is this a responsible way to cure our massive federal budget issues?
You're right that it sounds good. It certainly has a very shiny appeal on the surface. But in response to your question, no, this is not a responsible way to do it. And let me explain why. The problem is not that we shouldn't do anything about debt. I mean, I really think that we have made a lot of mistakes in terms of not raising enough taxes to cover the spending. So I think over the long haul, we've got to have a combination of probably some spending cuts and some tax increases to try to come closer to balanced budgets and hopefully even have surpluses in some years. But if you insist on balancing the budget in every fiscal year, that means that you would insist on balancing the budget during a recession.
Mm.
So let's think about what it would have been like if we had tried to balance the budget in 2009. Because of reasons that didn't have much to do with the budget, the economy was plummeting because of the financial crisis. And people were losing jobs. Ultimately, 8 million people lose their jobs. When you lose your job, you don't pay taxes. Economic activity was shrinking, so the tax base was going down.
Sure.
That was going to lead, if we didn't do anything else, that was going to lead to huge deficits. So now let's say you insist on not having a deficit. Well, what do you got to do? You got to raise taxes $1 trillion or so, or cut spending $1 trillion or so. Well, if you do that, what's going to happen? Those would put a further drag on the economy. That would make the recession worse. So you don't want to insist on balancing the budget during an economic downturn. I absolutely agree we need to do more to balance the budget. That's why I think we should vote for members of Congress who don't sign any no-tax pledge and who don't say no spending cuts, no way, no how.
And I mean, how would this actually work if suddenly you were to say no more debt? I mean, what would happen, let's say, to huge programs like Social Security, Medicaid, programs that are quite popular?
Well, that of course, is the rub. That's a real problem. Last year, we had deficits a little shy of $700 billion. That's way down from more than $1 trillion in the previous few years, but still pretty substantial. What would you have to do? You'd have to have a very major tax hike, or you'd have to, what would be the right order of magnitude? Well, eliminate the Department of Defense, eliminate Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
Those are of the order of magnitude that it would take to knock out $700 billion. And of course, back in 2009, it would have been much, much, much worse than that. So if you have a member of Congress who is facing a constitutional requirement that we balance a budget, and the member of Congress knows that he or she has to vote for a massive tax hike or for huge cuts in spending, that's a hard one to vote for.
Yeah.
And, of course, it would remain to be seen what exactly would happen. I should note that the advocates in the Michigan legislature for this, all the ones that I've spoken to, they keep saying, without any tax increases. Now, that's not written into the balanced budget amendment, but their goal would be to do it exclusively through spending cuts, which, of course, will be very difficult.
And that's exactly it. I mean, I think a lot of people would agree. It sounds good. It's important. You shouldn't spend more than you're able to. So is there a fix that isn't so drastic as creating, as calling for a constitutional convention?
Well, in the short term, we're actually doing all the right things. We're headed in the right direction. If you take the trajectory of the last couple of years, and if you keep on that trajectory, we would be balancing the federal budget in another couple of years. It takes discipline. It takes not coming up with any huge new spending programs or tax cuts. We have seen before that it's possible to do that. It is possible to have the discipline. You also need a little bit of luck in terms of not having some outside event cause a recession.
Mm-hmm.
But we had it in the last 4 years of Bill Clinton's administration with a Democratic president and a Republican Congress. They raised some taxes, they had a growing economy, they cut some spending, and we managed to balance the budget. So it is possible. And that happened without a balanced budget amendment. It happened through members of Congress making tough decisions.
Charlie, let's talk a little bit about the politics behind this. Attention was brought to the idea here in Michigan when Governor Snyder actually called for the amendment. He called for it in his State of the State address. And I think his support for many political watchers, it was surprising. Were you surprised from what you know about this governor that he was pushing for this balanced budget amendment?
I was a little surprised. I have to tell you that I was disappointed. I know the governor personally, and I don't want to be too critical. I think he's done many things good. He's pushed for some good policies. This is one with which I strongly disagree. I don't understand fully, because of his accounting and economics background,
yeah.
I'm sure he's familiar with the arguments that I was putting forth.
And that's what I'm trying to get at, that it seems sort of antithesis to what we know about him as a CPA. Is this what some are saying, some political watchers, that this was sort of a bone that he was throwing to some members of the Tea Party and some Republicans who are really pushing for this amendment?
I've heard people say that. It's hard for me to know for sure what was the reason why the governor threw his support behind this.
Yeah. Now, let's talk sort of overall. Why now? The economy, it seems to be getting better. It seems to be on a rebound. It's an interesting time for this to sort of continue to poke its head up.
That is a very good question. I think it may be that we have just had this continuing growth of the debt, and maybe we got to a number where the sticker shock was quite high. A lot of it, I think, is just jockeying for political position, because as we have both said, the balanced budget amendment to the Constitution is very attractive on the surface.
Yeah.
And if you don't dig below the surface, and if you don't think about what would actually happen if we had to balance the budget during a recession, I think it does have some appeal, and it's true. We've had, you know, people are frustrated. People on both sides of the aisle are frustrated that the Congress over a long haul and various presidents haven't had the discipline to raise enough taxes to pay for the spending programs. And so you think, well, if we can't get them to do it through voting for people who have good sense, let's use the meat axe approach of a balanced budget amendment. But I, as I've said, I don't think that meat axe will help the patient.
Charles Ballard, economist at Michigan State University. As always, Charlie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Zoe, for having me.
Oh, and Charlie also tells us that the whole argument that's made about, well, in my household, you know, we have household budgets, we're meant to balance our budgets, the federal government should too. He says, actually, that's not a great comparison. You may own your home, but really the bank probably owns your home, that you're actually probably in debt to the bank, you're paying mortgage payments, that you probably don't own your car outright, and that maybe you make car payments. So he says,
in actuality, although we say that we balance our budget every month, we probably all have a little bit of debt. General Motors has been in the headlines over its recall of more than 1.5 million vehicles due to ignition switch problems. That's being blamed for some 13 deaths.
Something went wrong with our process in this instance, and terrible things happened. As a member of the GM family and as a mom with a family of my own, this really hits home for me. We have apologized, but that is just one step in the journey to resolve this.
That was GM CEO Mary Barra offering a public apology last week. Toyota also in the news after having agreed to pay more than $1 billion to settle with the Justice Department. That's over a delayed recall of millions of its vehicles. But are U.S. consumers facing recall fatigue? Sonari Glinton is auto beat reporter for NPR. Hey, Sonari.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thanks. So you had this great story a few days ago about so-called recall fatigue. You spoke to an analyst who said, quote, "I don't think there's a manufacturer out there who isn't executing a recall at any given time." So I'm wondering, are people starting to just possibly tune it all out because it just feels like there are so many recalls?
Well, I don't know if it's necessarily because there's so many of them. Does the news get to you and how important it is? Now, what's interesting about that story is the reason I did it in the first place is I'm NPR's auto reporter. I went to get my car fixed or, you know, just to get a regular tire rotation and an oil change. And I realized the guy says to me, "Hey, you have a recall on your car from September."
And you were like, "What?"
No, exactly. And so, but this is, I think, what happens with a lot of people. And I have a relatively new car. It's 1 year old. Uh-huh. So I'm probably like, you know, up on my maintenance. I'm caring about it, et cetera, et cetera. But if you have a 6 year old car and it's not going to the dealer or, you know, it's not getting repaired, that idea may not get to you. That information may not get to you. The other thing is, the older your car is, a lot of these Chevys and Pontiacs, they're from 2005. They're 10 years old. They're probably not with their first owner. They might be with their second or third owner.
Right.
And the more owners you have, the harder it is to get that information to that person.
Sonari, is there this idea, though, about sort of crying wolf, that eventually people just start ignoring the recalls because it's just not that important? They have other things to do.
Well, with an auto recall, I want to say, if you get one in the mail, you need to get your car fixed. Just do it. It's free, so you don't have to worry about, you know, spending money. It may be a little time, but it's going to be free if you go into a dealer to get your car fixed. I think the problem with this is that most of the recalls come through the mail. And the mail from Chevrolet or from Volkswagen, it looks like, you know, they're trying to sell me something. They're trying to do something. So when I see something from the car dealer, I'm like, I don't need to buy a car this week. You know, and that's probably what happened to me.
Is it up to the automakers then to do a better job? I mean, who should the onus be on?
Well, you know, it's their product. You know, they seem to do a pretty good job of trying to sell me a car. You know what I mean? They do a pretty good job of getting in touch with me when they want me to get a new car, when they want to get new financing. You know, they know how to get right to me. You think that if they could do a better job of getting the information out. Now, they try, but I think that, and there's some impediments because, you know, a lot of privacy laws don't allow for cell phone numbers and sort of trading information. You know, they have to, this information comes from state registries and, you know, where's your car registered? I mean, it's not always the most up to date, but, you know, if we were able to capture, say, your cell phone data and you can get a text and you knew that it was only going to be an important text that said, come into the dealer and get this fixed, we might respond differently. With new cars and with some recalls, we can get as high as 70% participation. It goes down a lot as, you know, the cars get older, as I said, and you know, people sort of lose contact or with their original seller.
That's a good point. And let's listen to GM CEO Mary Barra explain how they'll be continuing to be in contact with car owners.
In my last message, I outlined the measures we are implementing to take care of our customers and to ensure it does not happen again. Since then, we mailed recall letters to affected owners on March 10th and 11th, it will send a recall service bulletin to dealers the week of April 7th. These letters and bulletins will explain the issue and the process for getting the switches replaced. As soon as possible, we'll also send follow-up letters to customers to let them know that parts are available, and that should start the second week of April. In fact, we are adding a second production line at our supplier to allow us to double parts availability.
So how do we figure out this fine line of, you know, making sure that people are being safe, going to get their cars fixed if need be, but also not crying wolf and making people just scared every time they're getting in their car to drive to work or go to the grocery store?
Don't be afraid if you hear a recall notice, but, you know, take your car in. If you get a recall notice, you need to get it fixed. You are not able to decide how important it is. If an auto manufacturer says that it's important, you know, then it is. Go get your car fixed. On our side, as journalists, I think that we have a responsibility not to sort of frighten the public. If you get a recall, you should go get it checked. But we should sort of be, you know, 900,000 Honda Odysseys were recalled because of a potential fire risk.
Yeah,
that is important, right?
Yeah.
There's no crying wolf there. You know, if one person is saved by going and getting their car fixed, that's enough. But we need to sort of give context to what this means.
So, Sonari, like we said, recalls have been in the news. The story of GM is going to continue because actually a week from today on April 1st, General Motors CEO Mary Barra is set to testify in front of Congress. Are we going to see, do you think, more recalls, companies just being more and more careful?
Well, the law says if you find out something that's safety related, you have to tell the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration about it within 5 days. That's why General Motors is, you know, in this is in this current situation. We're going to see recalls. It's going to, you know, there's been like a clip of, you know, several million each year, several million vehicles in total that mm-hmm. have been recalled. And we're going to keep seeing that. What's interesting about here's the weird thing about more recalls. That cars in general are safer than they've ever been. And each year, I'm amazed at the safety features that are added to vehicles. So we're going to see more recalls because, you know, companies don't want to be in the situation of Toyota or General Motors. But the thing is that when you hear about these recalls, it's important to remember that that cars are continually getting safer.
Mm-hmm.
And taking your car into a dealership is kind of, you know, it's that little extra assurance, you know, that everything is working well on this vehicle. And that's important for you to have for safety of mind.
Sonari Glinton, Auto Beat reporter for NPR. Thanks so much.
It's always a pleasure, Zoe.
And here at Stateside, we always want to hear from you. What stories are you focused on? What issues are you talking about? Let us know. You can find us on Facebook. Just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're also on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And you can, of course, find us on the website michiganradio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. And while you're there, you can check out stories that you may have missed. Stateside was produced by Mercedes Mejia and Allie Billings. Stateside was engineered by Tony Brown. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.